CFT and cosmology.
Can you hear me? Inflation in the very early universe seems the only natural explanation of many observed features of our universe, particularly the recent measurements of the Doppler peak and the microwave background fluctuations. It is usually assumed that inflation is caused by a scalar field that slowly rolls down an effective potential. But this poses the awkward question, why did the scalar field start out high in the potential? No satisfactory answer to this has been given. In the new inflationary scenario, the scalar field is supposed to be confined to zero by thermal effects. As the universe expands and cools, the thermal contributions to the effective potential will disappear, leaving the scalar field exposed on a mountain peak. This proposal is now not generally believed. The chaotic inflation scenario seems to lead to inflation at the Planck scale, at which all bets are off. And the no boundary proposal doesn't predict enough inflation. Instead, I want to go back to an earlier model, in which inflation was driven by the trace anomaly of a large number of matter fields. I shall show how the bad features of this model can be overcome. The standard model of particle physics contains nearly 100 fields. If, as we suspect, the standard model is embedded in a supersymmetric theory, the number of fields would be at least double, and maybe very much higher. Thus, a large N approximation should hold in cosmology, even at the origin of the universe. In the large N approximation, one performs the path integral over the matter fields in a given background to obtain an effective action, which is a functional of the background metric. One then argues that the effect of gravitational fluctuations are small, in comparison to the large number of matter fluctuations. Thus one can neglect graviton loops and look for a stationary point of the combined gravitational action and the effective action for the matter fields. This is equivalent to solving the Einstein equations, with the source being the expectation value of the matter-energy momentum tensor. Finally, one can calculate linearized fluctuations about this stationary point metric, and check they are small. This is confirmed observationally by measurements of the cosmic microwave background, which indicate that the primordial metric fluctuations were of the order of 10 to the minus 5. The large N approximation was first applied to cosmology in the 70s, particularly by the Russians. One of the main motivations was to obtain a model of the universe without an initial singularity. Instead, Grishka Kondzeldovich proposed that the universe was in a de-Sitter phase for an infinite time before exiting to a decelerating expansion. This model was developed in more detail by Starobinsky. He assumed there were a large number of conformally invariant matter fields, which would give the energy momentum tensor a trace anomaly that was a known function of the local curvature. In a de-Sitter background, the trace-free part of the energy momentum tensor would be zero by symmetry. Thus the energy momentum tensor would be proportional to the metric, and de-Sitter space would be a stationary point of the combined action. However, in order to get the universe to exit the de-Sitter phase, Starobinsky had to assume there were also non-conformally invariant matter fields that added a non-conformally invariant local term to the effective action. I must admit I didn't take this Russian model very seriously at the time. This was before we realized the importance of exponential expansion or inflation in solving the fine-tuning problems of the hot Big Bang, like horizons and space curvature. Also, why should the universe have expanded for an infinite time in a de-Sitter phase before becoming unstable and exiting inflation? What was the clock that told the instability to turn on? However, we can now recognize this initial de-Sitter phase as corresponding to the quantum creation of the universe from nothing via an instanton which was the Euclidean force sphere. Moreover, the ADS-CFT correspondence now provides us with a way of calculating the effective action of matter fields on backgrounds without symmetry. This was not available in the early days, so Starobinsky had to neglect non-local terms in the effective action. I shall therefore reappraise the Starobinsky model in the light of modern knowledge. My talk will be based on joint work with Harvey Rial and Thomas Hertog. The ADS-CFT prescription for calculating the effective action on a background metric is performed in Euclidean space, like all good quantum field theory calculations. One takes the four-dimensional metric to be the boundary of a solution of the Einstein equations with a negative cosmological constant in five dimensions. One takes the action of this solution, adds counter terms that depend on the geometry of the boundary, and takes the limit at the ADS length scale, and the five-dimensional Newton's constant go to zero. I shall be concerned with universes which, in the first approximation, are homogeneous and isotropic in the space directions. This means that the Euclidean metrics have an O4 isometry group, acting on three spheres. The five-dimensional solution will have the same symmetry, which means that it will be a Euclidean Schwarzschild ADS metric. If one adds the requirement that the three spheres shrink to zero size, as they do in instantons for open inflation, the Schwarzschild mass must be zero. Thus the five-dimensional metric must be pure ADS. One can now calculate the combined four-dimensional gravitational and matter field effective actions. The only O4 stationary point metrics are flat space and the four-sphere. The latter can be regarded as the Euclidean version of a De-Sitter space, where the cosmological constant is provided by the trace anomaly of a large N conformal field theory. These two solutions are the final and initial stages of an open inflationary model. However, in order to get a solution that interpolates between the two, one has to add an R-squared term to the gravitational action, as Starobinsky discovered. This can be justified as a local counter term in the effective action of non-conformal invariant fields. With this addition, the expansion changes from exponential to matter-dominated in a time scale that depends on the coefficient of the R-squared term. There are thus seven contributions to the combined gravitational and effective matter action. First, there is a five-dimensional gravitational action. This depends on the five-dimensional Newton's constant, G5, and the ADS length scale, L. These are not physical quantities, but are auxiliary variables introduced for the ADS-CFT calculation. The ADS length scale, L, acts like the cutoff for the large N matter quantum fluctuations. One is therefore interested in the limit in which L and G5 go to zero, with L cubed over G5 equals N squared, held fixed. The second term is the Gibbons-Hawking term, trace K, on the force field boundary. The third, fourth, and fifth terms are the counter terms for ADS, CFT. They are the area, the Ricci scalar, and the curvature squared term of the boundary, respectively. They remove the quartic, quadratic and log divergences in the five-dimensional action, as L and G5 are taken to zero. Thus they correspond to counter terms in the large N conformal field theory, in four dimensions. Even supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory is not finite in a general curved background. This is reflected in the fact that the third ADS, CFT counter term, proportional to the curvature squared of the boundary, is not covariantly defined. Instead, one has to introduce an arbitrary constant, beta. The sixth term in the combined action is the square of the Ricci scalar of the boundary. This is interpreted as the local counter term in the effective action of non-conformal invariant matter fields on the background, so its coefficient, alpha, is undetermined. We do not have a good way of calculating the non-local part of the effective action of non-conformally invariant fields. However, it is reasonable to suppose it is not too different to the non-local part of the effective action of conformal invariant fields. I shall therefore assume it can be absorbed into redefinitions of the number of fields and the conformally invariant counter term in the ADS-CFT correspondence. The seventh and final term in the combined action is the four-dimensional gravitational action. This occurs with a Newton's constant, G4, that is not related to G5 and L. I shall use Planck units, in which G4 equals 1. The model then depends on three parameters, N, the number of matter fields, and beta and alpha, the conformal and non-conformal counter terms. N is fixed by physics, but beta and alpha seem able to be given arbitrary values. The combined action is stationary under all perturbations, Hij, of the metric of the boundary, if the boundary is a force sphere with radius, r, of order n to the half. This corresponds to a de Sitter solution, where the cosmological constant is provided by the trace anomaly of large numbers of matter fields. For large n, the radius of the de Sitter space will be large in Planck units. Thus gravitational fluctuations will be small, confirming the consistency of the large N approximation. even though they are small, gravitational fluctuations about the D Sidern's Danton are important, because they give rise to galaxy formation, and the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. One can calculate the two-point function of the metric fluctuations as follows. First, one picks a perturbation, hij, of the metric of the force sphere. Second, one solves five-dimensional Einstein equations, with negative cosmological constant, for the region inside the perturbed force sphere. Because of the perturbations, this will no longer be pure ADS. Third, one calculates the action of the perturbed solution, including surface terms. Because a ball of five-dimensional ADS bounded by the round force sphere is a solution, the action won't have a term linear in Hij. Thus the leading term will be quadratic, of the form HMH. The inverse of the operator, M, gives the two-point function for the metric perturbations, Hij, for four-dimensional gravity coupled to large N matter. One can decompose the perturbations in the Balkan boundary into harmonics under the isometry group, O5, of the Euclidean D Sitter solution. The harmonics can be divided into scalar, transverse vector, and transverse traceless tensor. The vector harmonic perturbations are pure gauge, so they don't affect the action. The gauge freedom leads to closed loops of fatigue pop of ghosts, but they can be neglected in the large N approximation. The scalar and transverse traceless tensor perturbation equations in the bulk can be written in the synchronous gauge, H5 mu equals 0. There are no scalar solutions in the bulk that are regular at the origin of the five-dimensional space. However, one has to allow for the boundary force sphere to be at a variable distance from the origin. So this is a scalar degree of freedom. One gets a radial equation for each transverse traceless mode, in terms of the distance from the center of the five-dimensional ball. These radial equations can be solved with hypergeometric functions. Thus one can solve the five-dimensional Einstein equations in the ball bounded by the perturbed force sphere. This gives the quantum effective action of the large N matter fields on the perturbed force sphere. The scalar part of the perturbed combined action is shown on the slide. Note that it depends on alpha, the non-conformal counter term, but not on beta, the counter term for conformally invariant fields. If alpha equals zero, the action looks like that of a tachyon. However, it is the same action, though with opposite sign, as that for conformal factor perturbations of D sitter space, with a cosmological constant. We know that conformal factor fluctuations of this system are not physical degrees of freedom, but are limited by the constraints. It therefore seems clear that the second factor, in the large n scalar action, does not correspond to a physical mode. On the other hand, if alpha is negative, the first factor in the scalar action will correspond to a physical degree of freedom, which behaves like a massive scalar. For perturbations around flat space, this mass will be real, with m squared of the order of 1 over minus alpha. However, around the D-sitter large n instanton, m squared will be 1 over 2 alpha, and so will be tachyonic. This means that the D-sitter phase will be unstable, as Starobinsky discovered. The growth time of the instability will be 12 alpha times the radius of the force sphere. Since alpha is a counter term, there is no reason it should not be negative and quite large. If it is less than minus 10, there will be enough inflation to solve the flatness problem. A large negative alpha will also give scalar fluctuations in the microwave background that are small. The second order variation of the combined action for transverse raceless Hij is shown on the slide. Here P is the level number of the harmonic. The second order variation goes like P to the fourth, log P, at large P. This should be compared with p squared, for d-sitter with gravity in a cosmological constant. The effect of the large n-matter fields is to suppress short-scale metric fluctuations. The matter field effective action makes spacetime stiffer. They cause metric fluctuations to go to zero below the Planck length, rather than a foam-like structure, as is normally thought. To understand the transverse raceless fluctuations physically, it is helpful to write the propagator or two-point function as an integral over a variable q, rather than a discrete sum over harmonics labeled by p. Then poles in the integrand can be interpreted as particles. The transverse raceless propagator has one pole at q equals zero. For this value of q, the vector harmonics mix with the transverse raceless harmonics. This means that one can gauge three of the five transverse raceless components to zero, leaving two, which is what one expects for the graviton. The other poles in the complex Q-plane have the full five components that one expects for a massive spin 2 particle. The positions of these poles will depend on the counter terms alpha and beta. For beta sufficiently large, there will be no tachyons, but there will be ghosts, poles, with negative residues. Ghost poles in the propagator are normally taken to be a fatal flaw in the field theory. The reason is that they seem to indicate that one could have asymptotic ingoing and outgoing states, which had negative norm. This would mean that the evolution from the initial state to the final state is not described by a unitary S-matrix. Unitarity is usually taken to be an essential property of any respectable field theory. Some recent work I have done, however, shows that one can still make sense of a quantum field theory, even if it has ghosts. One no longer specifies the initial and final states as elements of a Hilbert space, so the issue of unitarity doesn't arise. Instead, the initial and final states should be described as density matrices obtained by tracing out over the time derivative of the field, which can't be measured. I will describe ghost busting in more detail elsewhere. It is enough to say here that unitarity is not defined in the early universe, because there is no asymptotic region. At late times, the departures from strict unitarity would be so small that we wouldn't notice them, even if we could observe graviton-graviton scattering, which we are never likely to be able to do. What we can observe, however, are the fluctuations in the microwave background. These can be calculated in the large N theory, even though it has ghosts. In the usual scalar field-driven model of inflation, there is a long slow roll down, during which the horizon size gradually increases. The amplitude of the microwave fluctuation is essentially the amplitude when the mode leaves the horizon near the end of inflation. In scalar field-driven inflation, the slow roll down means that the horizon at the end of inflation is much larger than the initial horizon. The fluctuations in the microwave background are therefore roughly 1 over the horizon radius at the end of inflation. In trace anomaly-driven inflation, on the other hand, there isn't a slow roll down. The solution changes from accelerating, exponential expansion, to a decelerating phase, with only a small increase in horizon size. The amplitude of the fluctuations will therefore be determined in the initial de-sitter stage. If the gravitational action were all that contributed, the amplitude of the tensor fluctuations would be of the order of 1 over horizon size. Since the horizon size will be roughly root n, the tensor fluctuations would be 1 over root n. Starobinsky visited DAMTP in Cambridge in 1980 and took the opportunity of being outside Soviet scientific censorship to publish a remarkable paper in Physics Letters. In it, he showed how to calculate tensor fluctuations of inflationary models before the term inflation had even been applied to the early universe. Starobinsky concluded that the trace anomaly inflationary model had to be abandoned because it would require 10 to the 10 matter fields to reduce the tensor fluctuations to the observational limit. Starobinsky assumed that the amplitude of the tensor fluctuations was not significantly changed by the coupling to the matter effective action. However, this assumption can now be examined using ADS-CFT. It turns out that matter loops can greatly reduce the fluctuations so that they can be compatible with the observations with only a realistic number of matter fields. For example, one can have n equals 10 to the 4 and beta equals 10 to the 3. The large n trace anomaly inflationary model requires tuning of the counter terms, alpha and beta, to fit the observations. But then, any other explanation of the microwave fluctuations also involves tuning. No one can predict an amplitude of 10 to the minus 5 in a natural way. Maybe we have to resort to the anthropic principle. I wouldn't claim that this model is the last word on the very early universe. For one thing, it takes no account of extra dimensions, except as a mathematical device, to calculate quantities in four dimensions. It may be that this is right. We have no experimental evidence of physical extra dimensions. On the other hand, there is a whole web of mathematical dualities involving 6 or 7 extra dimensions. Nevertheless, the model I have just described contains features that I expect to be part of the final answer. First of these is that gravity is only one of a large number of physical fields. Thus, even at the origin of the universe, the large n approximation should be valid, and gravity should be described by a background metric with small fluctuations in agreement with the observations of the microwave background. Second, the natural candidate for the background metric of the initial instanton that began the universe is a round sphere, at least in the four dimensions we observe. The analytic continuation of a Euclidean sphere is Lorentzian D-sitter space. Classically, this expands exponentially from the infinite past to the infinite future. Thus, it deserves the title eternal inflation more than the misguided scenario in which inflation is supposed to result from the quantum fluctuations of a single scalar field. Such eternal inflation would occur at the Planck scale at which the division into background metric and fluctuation breaks down, so all bets are off. In large N inflation, on the other hand, the horizon size is large compared to the Planck length. Thus the background plus perturbation split is well defined. However, the inflation does not go on forever in either direction of time. The infinite past of the classical de Sitter solution is replaced by the quantum creation of the universe from nothing, mediated by the Euclidean force theory. If the background metric expanded like de Sitter into the infinite future, it wouldn't contribute to the amplitude for a universe like we observe. This amplitude will come from metrics that exit inflation. One really doesn't care if there's also an amplitude for eternal inflation. The third feature of this large N model that I expect to be in the final theory is ghosts. In 1985, it was claimed that perturbative string theory was the only theory of quantum gravity that was both finite and unitary. However, perturbative string theory is not much good in cosmology, or indeed for anything except calculating graviton-graviton scattering. Instead, most of what is now called string theory uses the supergravity theories that were so rubbished in the late 80s. The fact that supergravity probably has higher loop divergences is quietly glided over. Somehow, it is felt that the finite loop behavior of string theory will eliminate ghosts and guarantee unitarity in supergravity. However, it is known that the loop expansion of string theory does not converge. If it did, we would be living in 10-dimensional Minkowski space, and physics would just be the S-matrix, and very dull. It wouldn't describe the origin of the universe, or black holes. So I don't think one can rely on perturbative string theory to save you from ghosts in cosmology. As I said earlier, one shouldn't be afraid of higher derivative ghosts. They are gentle, harmless creatures with whom one can live quite comfortably. Ghosts are not compatible with strict unitarity, but the way they prevent it is quite benign. The existence of ghosts means that one cannot prepare a system in a pure quantum state, or measure whether a given state is pure. Thus the initial and final situations have to be described by density matrices, and there is no S-matrix. One can never produce a negative norm state containing just ghosts. Ghosts are gregarious and demand the company of real particles. However, they appear only at high energy, so their effect will be insignificant in normal particle scattering, which will appear to be unitary to a high degree of accuracy. I have told you how the universe began, how structure developed, and how to deal with ghosts. I think that is enough for one talk. Thank you for listening.
So, are there questions? Questions?
Chairman, since the string theorists, the experts in this auditorium seem to be all quiet, Stephen, could I ask, if we take the recent observations of the high redshift type 1a supernovae seriously, the indications seem to be that the cosmological constant is perhaps positive. Is this a problem for us? Of the model.
the apparent small cosmological constant now is a great surprise. No one expected it. But that is how science moves forward. It is a great challenge, and I don't have the answer.
Any other question? If there are no other questions, let's thank Professor Hawking again.